Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I think part of what's so challenging about all these decisions, marriage, divorce, childbearing, not childbearing, is that it's so difficult to disentangle the expectations from what you want.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. This week, we're doing something a little different with the help of Ian Koss and the podcast he made about divorce and his family. The series is called Forever is a Long Time. Here's a little bit of the first episode. Ian is talking with his father, Tom.
Do you remember how Sebastian and I responded to you guys getting divorced? Because I have no memory of this.
Well, that's interesting you should mention that, because that's one of the few scenes that I really can picture. There was a therapist there at the Worthington Health Center. Can you picture that?
Yep.
Up on the hill in Worthington?
Yeah.
We brought you guys there to tell you that we were getting divorced. I remember that these tears just sort of spontaneously popped out of your eyes. And you're just like, I don't know. It was unlike you, because you're quite stoic in a lot of ways, but you just like cried instantly, and I can still see that now.
Ian grew up in Massachusetts and is 33. He's married now, and as he was making that decision, he started thinking about the many marriages in his family that ended in divorce. Not just his parents' marriage, but also his grandparents' and aunts and uncles' marriages. And he interviewed his family about this over the podcast's 5 episodes. I wanted to talk to Ian because I have some divorce stories myself. I got divorced when I was 30, and my dad was divorced with 2 kids before he married my mom. So I have 2 siblings who are the children of divorce. I'm really interested in the many perspectives and stories that can come from the end of one marriage. Ian ended up seeing his parents split as a good thing. They've both since remarried. But that is not how he remembers feeling as a kid.
I think the loss was the family unit, the fact that we lived together and did stuff together and all slept under the same roof. You know, when I do see those photos of us, there's like this wonderful photo of the, so I was born in this cottage on Cape Cod, that was in the backyard of my mom's, my Aunt Mia, the house that they lived in. And it was just, and we had beds right next to each other. My brother and I slept in the set of bunk beds, and my parents' bed was just like right up next to it. And there's these photos of us just like all as a family kind of splayed out on this side-by-side beds in this little cottage. And yeah, I think that's the loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're making me, like, whether it's good or bad, divorce is always a rupture. Mm-hmm. And for an adult to go through a rupture is one thing. To be a child without choice or agency going through a rupture is a whole other thing.
You know, my parents really only got together because they accidentally had a child together, my older brother, and then subsequently me. And I think one of the feelings I carried around for a long time around their relationship, their marriage, and our family, such as it was like a weird kind of guilt, like we had ruined their lives. And I don't know if that's a common feeling among accidental children, because we did change the course of their lives. And I sort of wondered what, you know, what they could have been if we didn't exist.
You said accidental children there. I was an unplanned pregnancy also. I always prefer the term surprise.
I like that as well. The part I never understood was how I was a surprise, because, I mean, I was number two, so...
Well, you know, it's interesting learning about your family, you know, that your parents got together, they had a pregnancy they weren't planning together, they had a child together, and then they had a second child together that was unplanned, that was you. But that wasn't when they got married. They didn't get married when there was a pregnancy. There was an intentional choice after they had two kids together to get married. What do you understand was why did they get married?
So I think there was a practical element that it just felt like we're doing this thing. We might as well make it a little easier on ourselves. And my sense in talking to my mother was that there was, you know, some, that she did invest a certain amount of emotional value in making that commitment to raise the children together as husband and wife. She grew up in a Catholic household. I don't think that idea of marriage was without any romance or significance to her. So I think there was some of that there too. Though obviously that feeling did not last very long. They were only married for a few years.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, and obviously this is something you cannot know, but have you thought about if they hadn't married and they split up, in the same way they split up later, do you think you would have experienced it differently if it wasn't called divorce?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I don't remember the legal proceedings. Obviously, I didn't experience those, but there was, you know, as married people, there was this added layer, this added complexity of untangling themselves from each other that I would imagine added a certain degree of kind of acrimony to the whole thing, and that maybe if they hadn't been married in the first place, it would have been easier to kind of ease out of each other's lives and continue co-parenting.
Ian's mother, Ellen, initiated the divorce. His father, Tom, initially resisted it. And both his parents attribute their opposite reactions to trying to shield their children from how things played out in the families they grew up in. Tom's parents had a bitter, traumatic divorce. And Ellen's parents didn't divorce. They stayed together for her sake. But Ellen believed her mother wanted to leave the marriage. Here in this excerpt, Ian's parents tell him what happened after Ellen asked for a divorce.
I mean, I never understood why Tom stayed with me. I really didn't. I mean, it was always a mystery to me because I don't think he ever loved me. He never said so.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she would tell you that I didn't love her and that I was just sticking around to be with you guys. And there's probably some truth to that.
And there were times I wondered, like late at night, whether he was coming home. And I'm sure that there were times when he was thinking to himself, shit, if I just keep driving, it would be easier that way, you know?
But I never would have ended it because I didn't want to put you and Sebastian through what I went through, you know, even if the marriage was not ideal.
But I just knew that I was hurting him and he was hurting me. And that despite the fact that we had two beautiful children together, we would be better apart.
Yeah.
And I was really sure of it.
When your mother told me she wanted to end the marriage, I was not expecting that.
He went completely bonkers.
I mean, now we're getting into like stuff that's a little uncomfortable.
We agreed that we would not get lawyers.
You know, it's like he said, she said, and
you know, he wanted a lot of stuff.
You know, I mean, divorce is never a pretty thing.
Like, this is a little weird.
You know, we had that bump in the road when she took out a restraining order.
We got into a pretty serious physical altercation.
Your mom and I had a fight about something.
And I called the police.
And I, in the heat of the moment and you know, not being very smart, I put my finger on the button, you know, and said, no, don't call the cops.
That was bad.
And I got in my truck and I remember stopping. There was a payphone and calling her, you know, and saying, I hope everything's cool and everything. But apparently the cop showed up.
And that's how we ended up with the restraining order.
The restraining order against me.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, didn't make me any friends.
That was probably the low point.
I have to say, when I was listening to your parents separately tell you about the divorce, and your mother says, I don't think he ever loved me. And then your father says, your mother will say, I never loved her. And maybe I never loved her. Like, to hear that. And then moments later to hear him describe the fury that she wanted to leave.
Yeah.
I was furious as a woman listening to that.
Hmm. Yeah. This is something I thought a lot about in making the show about how my parents come across, because divorce does not bring out the best in people.
No. I thought, oh my gosh, these poor people. Why are they having to talk about their worst moments of their, you know, like, oh, divorce is the worst.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think your reaction makes a lot of sense. And obviously, I don't, you know, my interest is not in justifying anyone's actions. But I think, yeah, I think what both of them said is true. And I think it's revealing about both of them that in that moment, my father felt so strongly about staying with someone he didn't love just to protect us from the D word, you know, from going through that experience that he had had.
Well, and I also felt like to protect him from those feelings coming back for him. It wasn't just protecting his children, it was protecting him.
Right. Yeah, and ultimately, I mean, the separation that ensued was, you know, I feel comfortable saying not traumatizing in the way that his own childhood experience was. And he knows that, and I think he understands that now.
Coming up, how Ian's childhood made him think about marriage as an adult.
She definitely put a lot more value into that idea of marriage than I did. Not terribly surprising, given our family histories.
and the stories of his family got us curious about divorce trends in the U.S. American divorce rates peaked in the late 70s and early 80s, with more than half of marriages ending in divorce. But since then, it's been steadily declining. By 2019, the divorce rate had been cut in half to just 27%. Marriage rates have been decreasing as well. But it's not just marriage rates that are falling, it's people who are partnered at all. Last year, more than 30% of American adults said they don't have a steady partner. That's the highest percentage since the data started being collected in 1986. Speaking of the 1980s, I want to let you know about a series I've been listening to from The Experiment, a podcast produced by our colleagues at WNYC Studios. They've made a three-part series all about work and family, and it centers on Spam, that processed meat in the blue and yellow can. There's a lot more history in that can than I ever knew, and this series unpacks some of it, from why it's a staple food for Filipinos to a pivotal strike at the Spam factory in the 1980s. This strike changed the town forever and the families in it, as you'll hear from people like Race Hardy. His dad worked at the plant.
Work isn't family. Work is for family. That's what these workers, it was about. And that's why there was such a disconnect. I mean, who chooses to snatch guts to pass time? You got to be kidding me. I mean, seriously, whose hobby? Have you ever heard of a hobby? Well, what do you do for a hobby? I snatch guts. I mean, that's absurd. To me, that's an absurd statement. Work is not about family. Work is for, if you're going to work in a packing house, you're working for your family.
You can find a link to the Experiment Spam series in our show notes. I hope you'll give it a listen. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on death, sex, and money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale.
Could you hold on 1 second? My wife is poking her head in the door.
Oh, are you in an interview?
Yeah, I'm doing an interview.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to eat lunch.
But that was your wife?
That was Kelsey. Yes.
We'll talk about her more in a minute.
Okay. Well, she's going downstairs now, so we can talk about her without her listening on the other side of the door.
Ian got married to his wife, Kelsey, 6 years ago.
I think it probably took a couple years from the point when we had been together long enough that we inevitably started thinking about marriage to the point that we did ultimately get married.
Ian and Kelsey started dating in college. And unlike Ian's family, Kelsey's parents and extended family are mostly still married. So the risks of a lifelong commitment didn't hit her in the same way they did Ian.
At any time, you know, we could, either one of us could just walk away and that would be it. And so, I mean, in some ways that's what marriage is, right? It's just like putting an artificial obstacle to ending the relationship so that it takes a lot of work to end it. And maybe that makes you think a little differently about it. And I say that a little like dismissively. That's not all that marriage meant to myself or to Kelsey. But I do think on some level, we were ready to, you know, we were at an age in our lives where we were starting to look ahead and to make decisions and plans. And it felt, and at that moment, it felt really nice to just decide, okay, whatever those plans are, we'll do those together. And just to have one known in all this, you know, this sea of unknowns. And to have that known be a person who I'd at that point been with for a number of years and been through a lot with and felt like I understood and who understood me. At some point, that began to feel like a really nice thing and not something that was scary, but something that was, that gave real comfort and additional meaning to our relationship.
As you were making the decision to get married, did you have fears that you would get divorced?
Yes. And I still have fears that we'll get divorced. At some point, you know, when we were contemplating getting married or after we got married, I did have a certain anxiety that it would just, you know, kind of sneak up on me and it would just suddenly the relationship would have fallen apart. And the longer I spend in it, the more I feel like I don't want to say like security that it could never happen, but a certain comfort in that if that ever happens, it'll be a choice we make and not just something that happens without us choosing it.
Maybe. That's the thing we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always
our spouses maybe. Can always decide to divorce us, you know, like, or
yep.
That's what there's this element of commitment to a marriage and a partner. And then there's also this leap of faith.
Right. I remember that was something my mother told me. It was like, It was funny in interviewing my family members, you know, it was mostly like the stories, but then they would like sprinkle it with bits of advice. Mm-hmm. I remember my mother being like, you know, by the time she brings up divorce, it's already over. Like, you know, so it's these things, you know, you got to, they will be percolating beneath the surface long before they are necessarily known to you, which is not terribly comforting to hear.
I don't know. Do you believe that? I think I just want to, like, to me, the idea that divorce exists and having that awareness inside a marriage,
yeah,
can also be this fuel that makes you continually making the choice to be together. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Like the knowledge. Yeah, go ahead.
Like, we have this issue. We need to deal with this,
right?
Because if we don't deal with this issue, in 10 years, I'm going to hate that you're still doing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to corrode us.
Right.
And so there's this idea that marriages are not a given. They mm-hmm. can be fragile.
Right.
And so they take care.
Right. Yeah. And I think that was always part of Kelsey's thinking. Things that are acceptable in the short term and you can just sort of live with, or say, you know, sweep under the rug, maybe require a different kind of attention when the time scale is your life. And yeah, and it forces a kind of care and attention.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, after talking to so many family members about divorce and what it was like for them to go through divorce, what it created the opportunity for in their lives when they were no longer in marriages that they felt like weren't working. Do you have a feeling about, like, when you think about divorce as a good or bad thing, as a tool of liberation or a tool of breaking up something that is sacred, you know, sort of where do you fall when you think about that spectrum?
Yeah. I would say that is something that changed for me in the course of making this series, you know, and doing these interviews with my family. Partly because, sort of on the liberatory front, on that side of it, I don't think I understood, you know, just how much divorce, the option to end a marriage and get divorced, meant for many of the people who I love most in this world, all of whom are women, not coincidentally, right? And so the fact that my grandmother and my grandparents were able to get divorced, the fact that my Aunt Rory in the 80s was able to get divorced, the fact that my parents were able to get divorced, I think each of those decisions, you know, in kind of hearing the full story to the extent that I could understand it, just felt like a really brave and positive decision for each and every one of those people. And that's not the case in every marriage. You know, I understand, and even some of the marriages within my family, the divorces felt more ambiguous than others. In terms of what the result was for the people involved. But I think overall, something my Aunt Rory said to me in the interview, which is in the podcast, and something I think about a lot, is just like, you know, to look at any situation and kind of see the gifts in it. And that's something that she does with her own parents and her own family. And I think, you know, for me, when I look at the legacy of failed marriages, quote, in my family, there's also a legacy of people really taking their lives into their own hands. And that's something I'm really proud of.
In the final episode of Forever is a Long Time,
Ian talks to his mom's sister, his Aunt Rory. She was divorced the same year Ian was born, 1988, and she never remarried.
I didn't want someone enough to deal with most of the stuff that I was already finding out about on the first date. Mm. And then I just didn't care anymore. You know, it just was a complete non-issue for me.
Yeah.
I was fine and happy and can't even imagine wanting to get into a relationship with someone and doing everything you need to do to, you know, involve yourself with someone's life that way. And in fact, sometimes I feel sad that I don't. I'm so allergic to cats because I'd be perfectly happy to be that woman at the end of the street with 15 cats. I wouldn't have any issues with that at all. So
I just want to say that, you know, I realize there are negative stereotypes around the idea of being a single adult woman. And I don't mean to harp on that mm-hmm. at all. In fact, I mean, when I look at your life, you know, and the fact that you've lived all over this country, you've traveled all over the world, you've had this remarkable career in medicine, you have hobbies, crafts, you have a wonderful home now with your sister, which is sort of like the hub of our whole family. I mean, and you've been able to do all of that partly because you sort of have this autonomy of self, you know, that you're not attached to another person. So I guess I'm kind of in awe of that in a way.
Thanks.
I think in some ways, like thinking about your family's story across generations, I was really thinking about like, you know, how much that was a plot point of how much mm-hmm. agency members of your family had.
Yeah.
And I also myself am divorced and got divorced in 2011 when it was a very different experience than what my dad went through in 1976. Mm-hmm. Some lessons have been learned about how not to divorce.
Mm. I mean, I do think I began from a place of feeling like they had failed at something that I wanted to succeed at. And now I can see it as like they succeeded at something really difficult. And that's not to say that I want to follow that example and necessarily get divorced myself, but I do want to follow that example and, you know, have the awareness of self that they had, to be able to live the life that I want, that feels most meaningful to me, and not feel bound simply by tradition or shame or pride or any of those things that I think can keep people in places that are not good for them for a long time. I know I'm curious. I mean, you've been divorced. Do you look at marriage differently now? Would you marry again? Does that institution sort of hold meaning for you like it once did?
It's interesting. I am married again. I've been married. I now call my second husband my longest husband as a joke. And we laugh because I've been married to him now longer than I was in my first marriage. And for me, my experience of divorce was it was like a crippling shame when I faced the reality that's not only what was happening, but also what I wanted. That took a long time. But for me, it was interesting. I didn't waver from this longing for still this traditional unit. I was very up for getting married again and wanted to get married again. And I think probably because I wasn't yet a parent and I was very clear that I wanted to be a parent. And for me, what I wanted was to do that with a partner if I could find him.
Right.
So I think what's confusing about divorce is we have one word for the experience of a marriage ending when there are no children and when there are children. And I think it's a much more complicated experience when the two married people have kids and the kids are trying to make sense of what's happening.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's... Yeah, I think as you heard in my parents' story, that's all it was about. You know, like there was no money at stake. You know,
the relationship itself was not terribly meaningful to either of them. It was really entirely about, you know, what do we do with the fact that we have two children and what do we owe to them and what is the best we can give to them and ourselves and how do we do that? You know, that's all it was about. But you're absolutely right. Divorce, yeah, it's one word for a lot of things.
That's Ian Koss, the creator of the podcast series Forever is a Long Time. It made a lot of year-end podcast lists, including in the New York Times, which called the series one of the 10 best podcasts of 2021. There's a link to it in our show notes. Listen, and you can get to know more about Aunt Rory and hear from Ian's wife, Kelsey. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Caitlin Pierce and Katie Bishop. The rest of our team includes Afi Yellowduke, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Our intern is Gabriella Santana. The Reverend John DeLure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSailPix, that's P-I-C-S. And the show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to Palmer Kurtz in Brooklyn, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Palmer and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. Ian does not have any children. That is another big life decision that he and Kelsey are weighing right now.
There are many things that I find very appealing about the idea of being a parent, but I also am that person who really likes to be able to just drop what I'm doing and bike out to a lake and just like swim out to the middle of it so that I feel small and alone in the middle of the lake and nobody can call me or find me. So it's just one of those processes of just choosing among the many paths of life.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.